We're discussing the Kyle Rittenhouse homicide trial with a distinguished law professor as jury deliberations continue. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A jury of 12 Kenosha County residents must decide whether the now 18-year-old Rittenhouse acted in self-defense when he fatally shot two men and wounded a third during protests for racial justice in Kenosha in the summer of 2020. Have you been following the trial? How do you feel about the testimony and what's transpired? What do you think of the self-defense argument? 800-642-1234. Janine Geske is a Marquette University Law School professor and former director of Marquette's Law School's Restorative Justice Initiative. She served as a justice on the state Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Justice Geske, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. When the jury started their deliberations this week, they received this 36-page document that contained all the legal principles and the definitions and the criteria that they should be using as they reach their decisions on the charges. This whole trial is really focused on self-defense. What should we understand about the term self-defense?
Well, and it's interesting because the jury received a booklet with it all and then asked later for individual copies, which shows they're paying attention closely to what the judge has instructed. The complicated part of self-defense in a criminal trial is that if a defendant, in this case Kyle Rittenhouse, raises enough evidence to at least argue that there was a valid self-defense, the burden of proof switches to the state. So the state must prove a negative beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Kyle Rittenhouse did not reasonably use self-defense. So if people have doubts whether it was reasonable or not, the jury is told to find him not guilty. So it's a very high burden. And, you know, in its own way, it's a complicated case because of all the videos and witnesses and different viewpoints. And the jury's obviously taken it very seriously.
The jury has sat there, and now they want to review that drone video evidence. What do you make of that?
Well, I actually predicted at the beginning that they would ask for more instructions and that they would do the video. They saw so many videos during that trial, both between the state presentation and the defense presentation, but they're focusing on the videos that show the shootings. And that tells me that they're looking very seriously at the charges. And if I were to guess, there is dissension among the jurors as to how they want to evaluate that testimony. So sometimes when some jurors feel one way and others feel the other, the best way for them to sort of argue to each other is to receive the evidence, and that's what they've done. So I just think they're just very methodically going through the instructions and making the findings they must make.
Some legal experts say that this case really shows how blurry and fragile the lines have gotten when people pick up a gun in the name of self-defense, that the legal and moral concept of self-defense, this doctrine that is sacred, isn't really equipped to handle an area of, you know, this time we're living in of expanded gun rights. What do you make of that?
No, I think that's true. Self-defense was historically really was that there was some conflict going on, and, you know, the person who was being attacked or potentially being attacked used some lethal force to protect themselves. But now we have these cases, both this case and the Arbery case, where we have individuals who get involved in a volatile situation and have these guns and grab these guns. And the question is, when somebody reacts to that gun, whether or not the person who owns the gun can now say, I was reasonably afraid for my own safety. I think this is going to really cause us to take a look at, you know, what does the introduction of guns, and in this case a very serious gun, an AR-15, into a volatile situation, what does that do in terms of being able to later assert self-defense?
So certainly looking at, you know, what precedent does it set as well for other trials?
Well, that's right. I you can take this to the next extreme. that if we had two individuals, both with AR-15s, approaching each other, where is the self-defense? Can they both shoot the other because they thought that they might grab each other's guns? You know, and there really is no guidance on those. We've expanded the sense of Second Amendment, and when people can carry these guns or take these guns, you know, clearly if Kyle Rittenhouse had not shown up that night with the AR-15, and even if he'd just shown up to be the medic he claimed that he wanted to be, we wouldn't be in this situation. But it was the insertion of that AR-15 in the situation that ultimately resulted in two people being killed and another person being seriously injured.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gueske. She's also a Marquette University Distinguished Law School professor. You can weigh in, giving us legal insights into the Rittenhouse homicide trial as the jury deliberates now for a third day. Your insights as well, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Matt is joining us from Nisida. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hello. So what concerns me most about the Kyle Rittenhouse case is the role the media may have played and how it could be influencing the jurors. For basically an entire year leading up to the trial, we heard that Kyle Rittenhouse had no family in Kenosha, that he had no reason to be there. That was wrong. That he transported his AR from Illinois to Wisconsin, and that was wrong. It was stored in Wisconsin. That he, you know, chased after the protesters, and that was wrong. There were a lot of things the media put out and influence public perception that's completely incorrect, as revealed by the trial. And so far, Rittenhouse has broken zero laws once the judge threw out the possession of a weapon by a minor charge. I'm wondering how the guest feels the media may influence public perception and the jurors.
Matt, thank you. Go ahead, Justice Gueske.
Sure. And those are all good questions in this time of social media and sort of unrestricted passing of information, wrong or right, through social media, there is that potential. I can only tell you that the jury has been very clearly instructed that they need to follow the laws and are being introduced. I was surprised that the trial judge did not sequester the jury, at least during the trial, because of all the social media. But it's within his discretion to allow the jurors to go home at night. The jurors all took an oath that they will follow the law and follow the evidence that's introduced. And they look like they're doing that. I mean, they're clearly not jumping to a conclusion or we would have had a verdict already. But it is a problem. It's a problem not only for the juror, but for the public generally to form their opinions when there's so much information, right or wrong, out in the stratosphere. And so it's made it more complicated to try a fair and impartial case when you have all the social media and the commentaries going on. But the things mentioned by the callers really don't go to the self-defense at the moment when the gun was shot. And that's what the jury's concentrating on. You know, when the individuals were approaching Kyle Rittenhouse, when he decided to grab the gun, when he decided to pull the trigger, that's what the jury's looking at to see what his mindset was and whether he was in a reasonable belief that his bodily safety was endangered at that time.
Going back to media, it's been interesting that anyone can watch wall-to-wall proceedings of this trial. And, you know, that too is a glimpse inside the courtroom that maybe people don't normally see. What has that done?
Well, it's interesting. Wisconsin was one of the early states to allow cameras in the courtroom. I became a judge 2 years before Judge Schrader, so I've been around as long. And early on, we had the Supreme Court in Wisconsin decided to allow cameras in the courtroom. I am a believer in that because I think it's important to have the public watching what's happening, understanding what's happening. And my experience is that most of the time, the lawyers and even the judge sort of ignore the cameras and try the case. But it gives people a sense of what happened in that courtroom instead of a few reporters reporting on it and then some verdict down the road. Now, that being said, in this case, there's been a lot of analysis, and the judge is quirky, I think. I think he's legally strong, but he's quirky. And so there's been a lot of attention spent to sort of his different kinds of approaches on things. But ultimately, I think, you know, people who wanted to hear could exactly hear what the jury heard and come to their own conclusions after listening to the instructions of whether Kyle Rittenhouse is guilty of these crimes or whether he exercised reasonable self-defense.
As you mentioned, quirky, let's talk more about Judge Schrader with Steve now in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi. What would you like to ask about the judge?
Yeah, you know, I watched not all the trial, but a significant portion of the trial. And what it reminded me of is a football game where one team is overmatched, and so they have to hold all the time. And then the people that are on the team that's holding are saying, hey, the referee is calling penalties on us. So that's why I looked at the prosecution. It seemed like they didn't have much of a case. They were throwing Hail Marys out there, and the judge called them on it and, you know, verbally reprimanded them, I think, for 12 minutes or so. Is that common when a defense attorney or a prosecutor is breaking the rules of engagement of a hearing and that the judge would admonish someone that publicly in that way?
And that's a great question. I can tell you in a high-profile, challenging case, which this one is, a lot of them aren't, it is not unusual. I think I have described what the prosecutor was doing was particularly on trying to get the evidence about her prior statement by Kyle Rittenhouse about shooting shoplifters, that, you know, he was clearly angry. He had ruled that that should not be admissible unless he decided differently in the trial, and the prosecution tried to slip it in without asking the court. And I agree with the judge that he had every right to be angry. One of the important parts to know about that is that his anger was not in front of the jury. The jury was out of the room, and he wanted to make it clear to the prosecutor he wasn't going to tolerate that. Those moments are not unusual in a high-stress, difficult case, and the defense has done a very good job of you know, preserving their record. The other thing I have want to comment on is a lot of those rulings have gone in favor of the defense instead of the prosecution. And to me, part of that is the judge is trying to preserve the record. And what I mean by that is not to let there be a lot of appellate issues that a defendant can argue if he gets convicted. So, you know, there are a couple motions for mistrial, and those will be grounds for appeal if he gets convicted. But the judge has had a lot of rulings go against the state, and I think he's trying to slim down that case so that if there is a conviction, there isn't a likelihood reversal afterwards.
We have a former state Supreme Court Justice and law professor Jeanine Geske presenting her analysis of the Kyle Rittenhouse case proceedings. What do you think of the self-defense argument in this trial? How do you see Rittenhouse, a patriot, a vigilante, maybe neither? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Justice Geske here on the Ideas Network. We're getting reaction to the Rittenhouse trial and the self-defense argument in particular on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Wednesday, we saw the 12-member jury asked about viewing photos and drone video evidence as they attempted to find consensus over whether to convict or acquit Rittenhouse on 5 counts, including 2 homicide charges. How do you feel about the video evidence presented? What stands out? Are you a Kenosha County resident? What is it like to live in these times? Still time, 800-642-1234. Marquette Law School professor, former state Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske stays with us. We heard from Nancy in Verona, called in, couldn't stay with us, Justice. And Nancy wants to know what role multiple gunshots play in self-defense. How can Kyle Rittenhouse claim self-defense if he shot someone multiple times, Nancy asks.
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And, you know, there were 4 shots fired in the one homicide. what the jury has to look at is what's reasonable under the circumstances. Now, you know, you could see, for example, when a police officer is defending himself or herself, it is not uncommon that there are multiple shots to make sure that, you know, somebody's no longer a threat. And Rittenhouse, that's what Rittenhouse was indicating, that he still believed after he had fired the first gun shot, that he still thought that his life was threatened. And so it's all into what 12 people believe was reasonable under the circumstances for Kyle Rittenhouse to believe. That certainly was a strong argument that the state has, that I think the first shot hit his pelvis and he was not armed, and the likelihood that he needed to put three more bullets in, one of which turned out to be the lethal bullet, was an excessive use of self-defense. But those are the kinds of questions that the jury is fighting with back there and trying to get their arms around. And they're not simple questions. Mm. And they're not the kinds of questions that we've answered in the past in other self-defense cases.
Nancy, thank you for that question. Let's go to Mary now in Madison. Hi, Mary. What would you like to ask?
Good morning. I wanted to ask about how the gun, the AR-15, became legal. It's a minor with this gun and it seemed the law that this team of lawyers found this loophole or looked at Wisconsin law, and somehow the judge was willing to consider this gun as almost like a hunting gun. The guy wasn't there for hunting. So could you comment on that?
Sure. Excellent question. And I have to tell you that was my same reaction you did when I heard that he had done that. So I also took a look at the statute. And I will tell you that in reading the statute and listening to the judge's ruling, I happen to think he made the right ruling. And let me explain why. The statute initially says that a minor cannot possess a dangerous weapon. And it lists what a dangerous weapon is. But then in that same statute, there's a provision that a minor may possess a rifle or a long gun if it is the standard length of a gun. So what it prohibits for minors are what we basically call sawed-off shotguns or shortened barrels, and those are illegal for minors. I believe the reason for that statute, and, you know, no one's had time, including me, to go back and research it, was that the legislature did not want to criminalize farm kids that used a gun on the farms or hunting kinds of situations where minors will often have rifles or long guns. And so that's how the statute reads. The only way that you can criminalize what Rittenhouse had in terms of a weapon would be for the legislature to change the statute. But the judge's role is that to apply the law as it's written by the legislature, and it actually does say what the judge said. It said how everybody missed it and the argument wasn't made earlier, I don't know. I think they probably weren't concentrating on it because it was a smaller charge compared to everyone else. But it was not as bizarre a ruling as it looked at first blush.
Mary, thank you for that question as we talk with former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske about the Rittenhouse trial. With your questions along the way here, Bruce now in Viroqua. Bruce, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I just wasn't sure if the jury was able to get the information of what happened after he was bailed for, what was it, $2+ million. He was spotted in a bar with the Proud Boys, who've been designated as a hate group, basically a neo-Nazi group, flashing white power symbols, wearing a shirt that says free as F. And I wonder if the jury has that information. If not, why not? It seems like it goes to show the larger picture of, like, he's basically an extremist coming to town with the AR-15. Basically a right-wing extremist.
Bruce, thank you. Justice Geske.
Well, and that also is an excellent question. And the answer is no. The jury was not told that. when there are other acts, they call those other acts, other actions that may not be direct evidence of the incident, but they bear on the defendant's character and his background, the judge goes through a balancing test of how relevant the evidence is to the issues the jury has to decide and how unfairly or how unfairly prejudicial it might be to the defendant. And this is a big judgment call by a judge. A different judge may have very easily ruled differently, but this judge decided that that was excluded, that the unfair prejudice was outweighed any probative value, as we say, or relevant value, that, you know, it was removed time and that it didn't bear on whether or not he exercised reasonable self-defense at the time. So the jury did not get to hear that evidence. Mm.
Bruce, thank you. Tiffany now in Madison. Hi, Tiffany, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if the jury's able to consider what the victims thought. So if they thought that they were stopping a threat and that's why they approached Kyle Rittenhouse, if they're able to take that into consideration.
Well, really, that is the state's argument, but they really are not taking into consideration what was going through the victims' thoughts. The concentration is what was going through Kyle Rittenhouse's brain at the time. And, you know, I mean, that's what the prosecution tried to ask them about that. Don't you think that they were trying to protect themselves? Don't you think they were going after you because you just killed somebody? And that goes into whether he reasonably believed that he was using reasonable force in order to stop a threat to himself. So you really are concentrating not on the state of mind of the victim, but the state of mind of the offender. But you take that all into consideration as to what was reasonable under the circumstances. And the state makes a very strong argument that, you know, he couldn't assume that these people were trying to kill him. He should have realized or did realize they were simply trying to stop him as a threat and somebody who'd already shot and killed someone.
Justice Geske, thank you for fielding these questions. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Justice Jeanine Geske, Marquette University Law School professor, former director of its Restorative Justice Initiative, served as a justice of the state Supreme Court. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.